This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
So this morning, the breakfast team and our listeners threw the most beautiful and emotional baby shower for Charnel. It was a morning of raising money for our village, which, by the way, is incredible. You are so generous. It currently stands at $32,542. So hand on heart, a huge thank you to everyone who's donated even a dollar to our village, because it is such a good cause. But in true baby shower form, there were cupcakes, there were games, and there was advice. But one caller who didn't actually make it to air had some great advice that they wanted to share with Charnel. And that was how she introduces her two dogs, Bruce and Barry, to their new baby girl when they bring her home. So, how do you do that? What do you need to consider when it comes to pets and new babies? We'll speak to a pet behavioralist in just a moment. But what has your experience been? How has your pet reacted when the baby came home from hospital? What did you have to do? Did you have to teach the dog or the cat how to behave? Some people you've heard have had to actually maybe get someone to babysit the pet for a whilst you bring the baby home and get settled and to make sure that everybody's safe. So let us know what you did, but we'll speak to a pet behavioralist in just a moment. But also this hour, we're going to look at why around half of us as bystanders are less likely to use a defibrillator on women. And the fact is, the reason why we don't want to do it is because women have boobs and we're embarrassed. But one small surf life-saving club is starting a campaign and it's called Don't Let Her Die of Embarrassment, which is wonderful. So do we need to look at something like that here? But how did your pet react when you brought the baby home? That's next.
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
So what do you need to think about if there's been a pet in your household for a long time, a dog, a puppy, a kitten, you name it, and you bring a brand new baby home? What do you need to think about? Or if you have a young child, if you have a young baby and you're thinking about getting a pet, what do you need to think about? Caroline Thursfield is from the RSPCA and is a vet and a vet behavioralist and a pet behavioralist. Caroline, it was a great call that rang through to our breakfast program this morning to wish Charnel all the best. But we all know that Charnel has two dogs, Bruce and Barry. What do Charnel and Nicholas need to think about when they bring their baby girl home?
I think we understand it's going to be a very difficult time, or very different time, for both Charnel, her partner, and the dogs as well. And encouraging them just to try and have routines as predictable as possible. It will be a little bit tricky with having less time, but having Bruce and Barry having their own areas, an area where they can feel safe, enjoy some treats, and feel comfortable with the new addition to the house as well. I think having a support system of friends or family that can be involved to help with dog walking, doing some games, just to ease that time, because as parents, you're going to have less time. You're going to be stressed looking after a baby as well. So giving yourself space and setting up things as early as possible is really going to be helpful for everyone in the household.
That's a great idea. Lining someone up to walk the dog, because the fact is you probably won't have time. And if you do have some time, you might want to be catching up on sleep. And friends and family, we're always thinking, what can I do to help? And there's only so many lasagnas you can drop over, although that's not true, right? There's never too many lasagnas. But maybe saying, can I take your dog for a walk, might be a great way to help, you know, someone that's brought a baby home.
Absolutely. Just having that time, yeah, for yourself and for the dogs to actually have as much opportunity as well. We all know just even getting out for a walk, having a bit of sniff, even some human interaction just was going to be really helpful for the dogs as well. But at times, you know, when you're doing things like changing the baby, doing baths, doing feeding, set that up with the time when a dog gets a really tasty treat. So, they, again, there's these positive associations that are being built too. So they're getting their fun and their rewards as well, and associating that with the baby rather than being left out of things.
And sort of, I'm not saying that dogs build resentment, but you don't want it to be, oh, every time this little thing's around, I get forgotten. You know, who is this traitor that's come into the house? I remember speaking to an expectant mum. She was quite pregnant, heavily pregnant, sort of around 7 months pregnant, and she had a pram and a dog. And I looked in the pram, as I always do, because babies are just so cute, and the pram was empty. And she said, oh, no, I'm doing a practice run, pushing the pram and being able to control my dog at the same time. And it's like, you smart woman, not only are you learning how to navigate a pram, which can be tricky, but also navigating a dog on a lead. Is practicing like with a pram or practicing with a doll, is that crazy? Is that a good idea?
No, it's a brilliant idea. And the earlier we can introduce these changes and props for the dog as well, so bringing out the pram so it's not suddenly a new scary thing that has a squealing baby inside, setting up the nursery, going for walks, carrying a doll around, swaddling your doll as if you were feeding it, moving around. So this is going to make it less stressful for new parents and less stressful for both dogs and cats. We shouldn't forget about cats in the household too. But setting up all of these changes as early as possible. And we do have these wonderful sound apps too where you can play baby sounds to your dog. Just have it going on in the background. Doesn't need to be 24/7. I mean, that will happen at some stage with the real baby. But just playing that at soft volume in an area, again, where the dog's feeling comfortable and relaxed. So we're just doing these gradual exposures rather than introducing everything all at once to our pets.
There's some really good points online which I want to get to in just a moment, but Caroline Thursfield is with you from the RSPCA. We're talking about how to introduce your pet to a newborn baby. Marilyn's in Parkdale. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I'm a grandmother now, but when I was pregnant with my first child, I rescued a little kitten. It was pretty terrified, so I just popped it in my apron pocket, you know, against the baby lump, not realising that'd create a bond. So when the baby was born, that cat was always very, very loving towards him. And if he ever fell over, he'd be the first one to check up on him. And, of course, when I had my second kid, the same thing. And they were just very close for the whole 18 years of that cat's life.
Wow. But we've spoken a lot about dogs, but, I mean, there's cats as well, Caroline.
Definitely. So I think with cats, yes, we shouldn't forget about them. And that's a lovely story from Marilyn with her kitten. And so with cats, we need to be thinking about their environment too, providing, again, safe spaces. So having igloos, hiding spots on high places on top of furniture where they can just have their own area to go to as well and feel calm. So we want to have separate areas, not only for safety, emotional safety and physical safety for our pets and our babies as well, particularly as those babies start moving around as toddlers and becoming more erratic and looking like little aliens to our pets, that cats have got that advantage of using vertical space. So there's lots of areas that we can set up for them as well. And again, just pairing those treats, high-value food, with the arrival or presence of the baby just to create that positive emotional response.
Quite a few people are saying, and Liz is one of them, that says, my daughter-in-law was advised by the vet to bring something home from the hospital that the baby has worn. The dog gets to smell it before being washed, no problems. And quite a few people are saying, you know, used baby clothes and smell. Is that like a known technique, Caroline?
So So for dogs, we know their sense of smell is one of their strongest senses, and they can pick up scents very quickly. So again, as part of having preparation of having nursery and items out, yes, we can bring home some clothing from the baby, a blanket, absolutely, and just allowing, again, that scent to come into the house and set that tone before we have that physical presence and noise as well.
It's something to take quite seriously. I mean, Anna says, we had to give our terrier away. It was just too jealous and aggressive. Another that says, if either of those dogs, and this is referring to Chanel's dogs, growls at the baby, that dog has to go. It's a bad sign. You can't take the risk. So when you bring the bub home, and if the dog does bark or growl because it's never seen or smelt or been in front of that baby before, is that a bad sign?
I think it's a sign we need to be aware of. Dogs will communicate stress and anxiety, and we can see growling as a sign of fear and discomfort. There may be other signs that we see earlier, and I think if we're seeing signs of stress, that would be, I would encourage people to reach out to get some professional help. As RSPCA, we have a list of recommended dog trainers, behaviour trainers and veterinary behaviourists as well that can assist to integrate and create a harmonious home. But we need to think most of the behaviours we may see from dogs or cat are actually coming from fear and stress. They're not from jealousy. It's not trying to be nasty or be dominant. It's actually a stressful time for pets, as it is a very stressful time for new parents as well.
Helen says, as the pooch already senses the baby in the womb, when the baby arrives home, allow the pooch to sniff the baby from head to toe. That's from Helen. Is that good advice? Gosh, that would be a nerve-wracking moment, wouldn't it?
I think again, we've got to know what the dog is doing. I wouldn't, I'd be setting up areas where the baby gate in the nursery, where the dog can come close, but a comfort rather than bringing the baby over to the dog.
Yeah.
Same thing when we're talking about patting dogs. We don't want to approach their space. We're allowing the dog and the cat choice, but safety as well, and allowing just them to be gradually introduced to
new baby. And I mean, this is a text that just ends with sob. It says, when our newborn appeared, our beautiful 2-year-old cat ran to the furthest corner of the house upstairs and hid so well we couldn't lure her out, even with her favourite treats. She appeared to be terrified. A few days later, she wandered off from our garden and we never saw her again. Oh, I mean, that's awful, isn't it? But, I mean, it's nobody's fault, but you just never know how an animal is going to react.
Yeah, and I think that's where preparation is key. The earlier that we can set up these changes, slow introductions and changing into the household and building up positive experiences, that should reduce the level of fear and anxiety for our pets and for the new parents as well.
Just finally, Caroline, lots of sort of different texts coming in depending on the breed, and this is in around dogs as such. So everything from Labradors to Golden Retrievers to Terriers, you name it. Does the reaction depend on the breed?
No, I think that it's a very individual response. It depends on the relationship that the dog has with their carers to start off with. Do we have any pre-existing behavioural concerns that might be exacerbated if we've already got a dog that has some degree of anxiety or fear? Is that going to be more heightened by bringing in a new individual in the house, whether that's a baby, another dog, a housemate? So I think knowing the individual dog rather than breed.
All really good advice. Caroline, is there somewhere on the RSPCA's website that sort of has some of these facts or questions that you can ask when it comes to pets and babies?
RSPCA does have a behaviour hotline. There's a 20-minute free video call that people can book in and have a discussion. We can. It's a nice way to discuss any concerns, set up for success, and we can then link to resources as well. And we do have, as I said, a list of our recommended trainers and pet professionals to provide assistance should people need that help.
And I guess if you are training your dog or if you have a new dog, to let that trainer know that you're pregnant or that, you know, that there is going to be a young baby in the house. I love that there's a behaviour hotline. Thank you so much for all of your insights, Caroline. It's really good.
Pleasure. Thank you and all the best for Chanel and her new journey.
Absolutely. Caroline Thursfield from the RSPCA. And thank you so much to the caller who rang through, who we sort of basically just rang out of time to be able to put to air, which said, in terms of little bits of advice to give to Chanel and Nicholas when they bring their baby girl home, what to do, what helps, what doesn't. They said that you need to be careful, or you need to at least think about how your dogs will react when your baby girl comes home. And all of the money that is raised today for Chanel's baby shower, it goes to Our Village. You can still donate. You can head to abc.net.au/Melbourne to donate there. So the money goes to Our Village, which is a Melbourne-based charity that basically provides all of the essentials that mums and parents and babies in need, all of those things they need in those early stages. And as I said, over $32,000, can you believe that, has already been raised. There is the aim to try and get it to 50 by the end of the day. Chanel would have been happy if it was like $500. So it just shows you how generous you are. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to look at why every second person has a memoir. Do you read them? And what's the difference between a memoir and an autobiography?
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
So every second person, it seems, does have a memoir. But what makes you actually pick one up? And what makes a good memoir? What details do you want to have in it? And what makes it different from, say, an autobiography? So Liza Minnelli has just released a memoir, and basically anyone and everyone she has ever met is fair game. It's called Kids, Wait Till You Hear This, and it's Liza Minnelli, and she's told that story to her longtime friend Michael Feinstein, who has written this for her. So just one of the details that has been penned in this memoir, and you may remember this. So back in 2022 at the Academy Awards, Liza Minnelli was on stage. She was using a wheelchair and she was presenting an award. And she was presenting that award alongside Lady Gaga, who stood there beside her. Now, at some point, it did seem like Liza Minnelli was starting to fumble on her words a little bit. And we saw this moment where Lady Gaga grabbed her hand and said, "I got you." And it was sort of held up as this really touching Hollywood moment, you know, this moment of feminism and two women looking out for each other. However, in Liza Minnelli's memoir, she says the complete opposite. She said it was degrading and it was patronizing, and she didn't want any of that to happen. So is that what you want out of a memoir? Do you want those kind of juicy details? Tony Jordan is a novelist who's also been a judge in both fiction and non-fiction book prizes. Tony, I mean, are you a fan of a memoir? It feels like you can write multiple memoirs. You can write as many of them as you like at any period in your life. Are there no rules with memoirs?
Rochelle, is there anything better than spilling the tea, than sitting down with a cup of tea and imagining Liza Minnelli there opposite you, slagging off at Lady Gaga? I mean, honestly, it's priceless.
Anyone I wouldn't want to cross, it would be Liza Minnelli.
Imagine what her little black book is like. She would have known everybody through all those years of Hollywood. She would have opinions on them all.
See, now this is a memoir I'd want to read. You want to know something that you don't know already. But what I feel like at the moment is that there's just so many memoirs and people are writing them at the age of 20 and 30. And I just wonder, is it this free-for-all and is that okay?
Well, there are a lot of them, it's true, but we still are getting really great stories. I think in my mind, there's a few different categories, and one of them is ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances, which is something I always want to read about. And then there's the category of famous people looking back over their lives through a particular lens or their life in general. And that's something, again, I always want to read about.
So is there a difference between a memoir and an autobiography?
Well, the definition is a little blurry these days, but traditionally what it means is an autobiography is your life. So you start with your childhood, you move forward, you explain, you know, how your life sort of panned out. I'm thinking of something that some of the very old classics in literature, like Gorky, the Russian poet, wrote three volumes starting from his childhood, moving through to his adult life. And the idea of a memoir is that it's often more focused. So the structure can be just about a certain period in your life, or it can be about a certain theme, or, you know, it moves backwards and forwards in time in kind of a looser fashion.
That's sort of, we're seeing that happen with music documentaries and docuseries at the moment. So I'm thinking of the Bruce Springsteen music documentary.
Yes.
It's not about his whole life, right? It's about the recording of one album.
I think that's a much smarter choice, actually, for these biopics, because very rarely does someone's entire life conform to the shape of a plot of a movie.
Yeah, and how do you squeeze it all in? And
Absolutely.
What do you leave out and what do you not?
Absolutely. So having a particular focus, it's about this or it's about that, is to me a much smarter way of doing things.
The idea of not writing it yourself to either have a ghostwriter or a longtime friend. I remember reading Matthew McConaughey's memoir and I could just hear, because his voice is so iconic.
Absolutely. Voice, you can just imagine it in your head.
It was so great. It was simply written. I could tell that he wrote it and I knew what I was getting myself in for as I was reading it. But there was something quite charming about knowing that he had written it. However, there are others, Demi Moore's, she wrote that herself as well. And I was like, I don't know if this is the smartest move.
But when you say wrote that herself, are there quote marks around herself, Rochelle? Because how would you ever know?
Well, exactly. This is my thing, right? How do you know?
I think there are ghostwriters for almost everybody who do, like some people are upfront about it in their memoir that they worked with someone, and other people just want you to think it was all them.
So what are some of the good ones that you've read? Like what are really classic standout memoirs for you?
One thing that I go back to reading like quite often is, I don't know if you remember this book, Kate Holden's In My Skin.
Oh, yes.
So that was her story.
That was a while ago now, wasn't it?
It was a while ago, but it is something I go back to because she was, I guess, what you would call a sort of suburban schoolgirl who found herself addicted to heroin and living life as a prostitute, and then how she sort of recovered from this period in her life. And that, again, is the kind of thing that has a natural story structure. This is a normal person, something happens to them, and then they kind of come out the other end. But Australia has had some cracker memoirs. The other thing that has been eternally popular is Magda Zubanski's Reckoning.
Gosh, I'm just thinking back to Kate Holden's book. I can remember passing that around. We all read it in our circle of friends and we all passed it around to each other. And once someone had read it, we passed it on to someone else. And you know when you get a book and the front cover is all curled up and it's a little bit stained.
Yeah.
And
you can see the love. It's in love.
Absolutely. And grotty. And just finally, the idea of writing multiple memoirs. How do you feel about that, Tony?
I feel that sometimes people have bills to pay, Rochelle. It's like the memoir number two, Memorial Swimming Pool, is what I think. I think if you're famous and you know people will buy it, well,
why not?
Put the money in your pocket and do something fun with it.
And as long as people read it, do you think you're going to read Liza Minnelli's?
I certainly will read some of the extracts. I'll certainly read the juicy bits.
Yeah, 100%. I'll read it and highlight it and then pass it on to you, okay?
Exactly. Perfect.
Tony Jordan, thank you. Novelist.
Always a pleasure.
And judge as well of both fiction and non-fiction books. Talking memoirs. That was all sparked because of Liza Minnelli's memoir, which has just been released, and it's called Kids, Wait Till You Hear This. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to look at the idea and the growing world of trauma in informed education. What is it? What does it look like? What does it mean either for someone in your life as a child, as a carer? What does it mean for you as a teacher? And we've also been talking about how do you get your pet ready when you bring a baby home? What do you need to think about? Marie's in Yarraville. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
I'm really good. What do you want to share?
Well, I had a 9-year-old spaniel at the time when my first daughter was born, and other people were very worried about it. And she was an inside dog, and I had the nursery door open. I put things out and around for her to smell and just get used to it. We bought the capsule home. Now I'm going to get it here. Put the capsule down. The dog went straight to the capsule, walked around it, and we had bliss for the next 3 years of that dog's life. She was wonderful.
Oh.
Absolutely wonderful. And it was such a relief.
Oh, it is emotional, Marie, isn't it?
Yeah. She'd been sitting on the couch next to me reading or watching telly, you know, the dog. And all of a sudden I'm breastfeeding and she's trying to nudge up, and she nudged up and sat next to me.
Oh, Marie, thank you. I mean, this all started because we had a caller ring through this morning who we didn't have the chance to bring to air, who said that Charnel and Nicholas, they do need to introduce their dogs to their baby. Bruce and Barry are the name of their two dogs, and they need to think about those steps. But some of the things that you've already done to ensure that that handover, you know, of the household works smoothly is just incredible. Marie, thank you. And in around 15 minutes' time, we're going to talk about a new campaign that started at a Surf Life Saving Club in Lismore. And the campaign is called Don't Let Her Die of Embarrassment. And it's looking at the fact that 50% of us as bystanders, if you go to use a defibrillator, you won't use it on a woman. And the reason is because we're too embarrassed, that you may need to expose the woman's breasts, you may need to open up her shirt, you may need to remove a bra, whatever it may be. However, we need to really think about that, because the last thing we want is someone who's in cardiac arrest, not getting the training or not getting the help that they need because of embarrassment. Aaron's in Frankston. Good morning.
Morning. How are you going?
Good. So you did training just yesterday, yeah?
Yeah, I did my CPR refresher yesterday. And the trainer actually spoke on this very, very topic. He gave us a story. Well, maybe I'll go on to the story later. But he said, you know, basically, you know, every second counts, and that heaps of women, you know, don't get the support or the necessary life-saving measures done as a result of people being a bit, you know, embarrassed to perform CPR due to their, you know, breasts, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's great that they raised that as well. It's been some time since I've done my first aid training. We were shown how to use a defib, but I don't think that was raised in any way. And we know now there are calls for more and more of these machines to be not just at Surf Life Saving Clubs, but to be in workplaces and to be in shopping centres as well, Aaron.
Yeah, the trainer said that I think the Red Cross were going to bring out women dolls in order for people to train on, because doing the actual training itself, the dolls are, you know, generally male orientated. So you don't get that, I guess, embarrassment of doing it. So he actually gave us a story, and I hope he doesn't mind me retelling it.
Oh, no, look, you've just reminded me, though, that you're right. The doll that you use is a male chest, and I think it's important to have a female chest as well, because it's very different. And, you know, where you put those little sticky, you know, suction cup things and what you need to do. Good on you, Aaron. Thank you. How are you feeling now that you've done your training? I remember I was on high alert after I'd done mine when I was on the train and driving around. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I do it every year. So, you know, necessary for the part of my job. So it's definitely worthwhile, and I recommend everybody out there at least do their first aid every 3 years and their CPR every year, because you never know, you know, what's going to happen. You could turn around a corner while you're driving, yep, and there could be an accident. Highly recommended, you know, just to at least get that awareness, because everybody goes into that flight or fight response.
Yeah, such a good point, Aaron. Thank you. Harriet's on the Mornington Peninsula. We've been talking pets and babies. Morning, Harriet.
Oh, good morning.
What did you want to share?
Oh, I had twins. I still have twins, but when they were babies, I had twins and a Labrador, and it was the most beautiful relationship because the dog was so thrilled that food was just coming at her all the time. You know, they'd sit in high chairs and the dog would sit in front of them like playing tennis, watching.
Oh, yeah. Know your food source, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Did you do anything like some of the ideas that we've had of bringing home something, you know, some clothes, something that smells like the baby, or doing a practice run? Yeah. Did you do anything like that?
Well, I didn't do the practice run. I think that's an awesome idea. It didn't even occur to me. I did have the pram set up in the sitting room, but I did also, I did bring home a little towel that I'd sort of rubbed on them, sort of almost like when you take a puppy home, you take something that smells of their mother. So I did do that with the kids. I sort of rubbed a little face cloth over them and brought that home. But she was fine with them. It was just more about making sure that they, as they grew up, they didn't climb on her or anything.
Yeah, didn't accidentally hurt her as well, because they're a lot bigger at that time, aren't they? Harriet, thank you. You can keep those calls and texts coming through. Our number's 1300 222 774. Up next, if you're a teacher, if you're a parent or a carer, then no doubt you've heard of the term trauma-informed education. But what does it really mean?
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
So it's a term when we went to school maybe we'd never heard of, but you're probably hearing it more and more now, and that is trauma-informed education. But what is it? What does it look like in reality? How are teachers trained? And is it just another thing for them to worry about in the classroom? Associate Professor Tom Prunzel from the University of Melbourne. Tom, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. You have done a lot of work in this space. I know you've worked with Berry Street. You were headhunted from New York many, many years ago. Before we get into what trauma-informed education is, let's take you back to New York and your history and where and how you started working in this space.
Nice to see you again, Rochelle. You're taking me way back to New York. I will fully admit to you and our listeners that my knowledge is about 17 years old now. When I was a teacher for many years in the Bronx, and I also was a leader across schools and systems in Harlem, we did not have a word yet to describe a helpful, proactive response to supporting students' needs and their strengths. We often, I would now say, reverted to sensing that we needed more punishment or we needed tougher consequences. And if we just did more, that the student would develop the insight to be able to regulate themselves and make better choices. But that instigation of struggling as an everyday teacher and leader has basically led me to the University of Melbourne.
So when we say trauma-informed education, I mean, that's, I guess, a very academic term to use for think about the person, think about the individual and why they are acting or reacting the way that they are. Is that right?
It is. And Rochelle, I love the opportunity to try to understand some of the terminology because it's really confusing. The word trauma is unfortunately ubiquitous. And what I do find is when people use that word, they're usually correct. I mean, we can use the word trauma to describe a very disruptive event in a community, or we can use the word to describe something that we feel when we feel stressed, overwhelmed. And already you can start seeing my synonyms in here, because I want our audience to consider that capital T trauma is a very serious situation. And that is often when we perceive that the world is no longer there for us or there for our physical safety or our psychological safety. What I want us to consider is that trauma-informed education is a proactive response for schools. And I think the most important word is in that phrase is informed. Mm. That when I was a teacher, and many of us, when we're a bit older than we used to be, when we were becoming teachers, we didn't have the science of what stress does to our bodies. We didn't have the science around understanding what it takes to build well-being in schools, or a science behind what it means to help students and staff meet their own needs for learning. That evidence informs us. And I'd like to suggest that once we learn this evidence, it's really hard to go back.
Is it always obvious? when we hear the word trauma, and for what most of us associate with the word trauma, and then you take that and you put that lens over a classroom, is it always obvious? Like, is it necessarily the young kid that's acting out or trying to punch someone? Or is it something totally different to that? Could they be withdrawn and sitting in the corner or not be there at all?
I think you've just given us an excellent definition, a bit of color here to describe what I would say is acting out behavior. It is obvious. This is clearly when a student cannot meet their needs in healthy ways. But the other side of it is what you just described as acting in behaviors. That's when a student may feel that stress in a situation when learning and want to give up. Maybe their head goes down or they just stop continuing on that work. What I want to be clear about is our research and practices are not turning teachers into therapists or clinicians or psychologists. That's a very particular qualification. And I would say that clinical and therapeutic work, I want the professionals who are trained that way to do that work with families and within systems and communities. Teachers, I want you to be informed by this. And once we are informed, we can help students meet their own needs in productive and, I would say, ways that contribute to the classroom community.
So how do you support, though? Because that's maybe easier said than done. If that is a support teacher, and we know that there was a period where support teachers were actually going to be reduced, especially in regional and rural areas. So when we talk about supporting a school, who does that? How do you do that?
Yes, well, with my friends and
how long have you got?
I'm here. With my friends and collaborators, I want to name them from both Berry Street and QUT, Queensland University of Technology. We have developed something called the Eucalypt Way, and that isn't that's a free resource. Anyone can look up the Eucalypt Way and find our practice model for how we might be able to implement trauma-informed education across Australia. And I'd love people to look at that free resource because it invites us to learn this research, then embed this in our schools as a whole staff proactive, universal approach for all, and then we have to work towards sustaining it. And right now, I am initiating and running research projects to validate this and to continue finding schools that I would call lighthouse schools who are doing this. Some of our
Can schools reach out to you and say, look, I think our school would benefit from one of these programs? There are families that need this help and assistance, and there are teachers that need this help and assistance?
Absolutely. I'd love to be contacted because I've got a lot of friends and colleagues and professional peers across the country that we're doing this together. I also know that this is a whole community approach, and it's tempting to think, oh, we might live in a community where there are obvious markers of inequity or obvious markers where families need community-based supports. However, we also do this work and research in what I would describe as very high-flying schools with high-flying students.
Yeah, don't throw a stereotype over where trauma lives and how it manifests and who can experience it. Absolutely, that is at your own peril and it should never be stereotyped. Just finally, Tom, where do we sit globally? Yes, you know, close to two decades ago, you were doing this sort of work in the Bronx, in New York, and now, you know, for years been working in Melbourne in this space. Where do we sit globally? Are we cutting edge or are we catching up?
We are cutting edge.
Really?
In that, being here in Australia, it is a privilege in terms of the way that the authorizing environments across the country are prioritizing trauma-informed and well-being engagement strategies. We have trauma-informed practice as a priority for initial teacher education here in Victoria. We have states and territories across the country that are unifying trauma-informed strategies with progression for learning strategies. That is both unique in the world. However, it's an important privilege and opportunity to lead and continue developing the evidence base and the strategies because there are other countries that we support around the world that do not have the same systemic factors to arise as innovation. So, yes.
So if there is a principal or a family member listening now that would like to reach out and potentially benefit from one of these programs, how do they do that, Tom? Is it through the University of Melbourne?
Well, you can sure contact me through the university, yep. and I will take all callers and let them know.
You might regret that.
Let them know where I think, based in their community and in their context, where they might find the support that they need.
Thank you so much for your time. Associate Thanks, Professor Tom Brunzell from the University of Melbourne.
On 774 ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Rochelle Hunt.
And keep those stories and calls coming through on how you got your pet ready, dog or cat or whatever your pet may be, how you got them ready for when a new baby was brought home. This, my newly born grandchildren climbed all over my Belgian shepherd, sat on him, pulled his woolly tail, stood on his outstretched legs and more, and he never even flinched. That's from Barry. But we've also been talking about a campaign that's been launched at a little surf life saving club in Lismore, and it's called Don't Let Her Die of Embarrassment. And it looks at the fact that around 50% of bystanders, if you had to use a defibrillator, wouldn't do it if it was on a woman. And if you are training in CPR, if you're training in first aid, are the dolls that you use, are they male or female? Do they have breasts or not? And do we need to not think about, it doesn't matter if you need to remove someone's shirt, if you need to remove someone's bra in order to help them, in order to keep them alive, especially if they're going into cardiac arrest. This text from Annie. When I was a student nurse in hospital in the 70s, our dummy was a female. Oh, no, sorry, there's no name on this, but the rescue doll, the dummy was known as Rescue Annie. There we go. 1-300-222-774. Simon Cowie is a sudden cardiac arrest lead at the Heart Foundation. Simon, it was incredible to look at this campaign that's been started by just a little surf life-saving club called Don't Let Her Die of Embarrassment. I was quite shocked to read the stat that around half of us as bystanders wouldn't use a defibrillator on a woman.
That's right, Rochelle, and thanks for having me. It's a great campaign, and sadly, yes, the data you're referring to is correct. We have data from here in Australia and in Victoria and across the world that shows that there is significant disparities in using a defibrillator or an AED on a female as opposed to a male. And there's a kind of a wide range of reasons for that, including not being one to accuse of anything inappropriate or exposing a woman's breasts or not even being certain if it makes any difference whether someone's a male or female.
So, because a text did come in saying, well, you don't want to be seen as doing something inappropriate. And let's say you expose a woman's breasts, you place the defibrillator on her chest, you do what you think is right at the time, but then afterwards she isn't happy and she is upset. Are you protected? I know that there is something like a Good Samaritan law or, you know, a bystander law. I'm presuming you, if your intentions were right, that you would be protected.
That's right. And the Good Samaritan laws state that as long as you're acting in good faith, and so, you know, doing things to the best of your ability and your knowledge, then you are protected as a bystander. And it's some of these myths that we're really trying at the Heart Foundation to dispel right across the country, because we know it's those first, you know, 5 minutes before paramedics arrive that are really crucial to improving survival rates.
Training. Do we train on male dummies?
Sadly, yes. The majority of dummies around the country for sale now, and we've recently run into this issue ourselves when we're trying to purchase some female mannequins, is that they are harder to find and there are fewer suppliers. And I think if most people, when they're going to first aid courses or training, they are unfortunately male, and where this could potentially play into people's hesitancy to act.
That's disappointing, isn't it?
It is. It's very disappointing.
Yeah. I wonder, how do we change that? Is it just looking, is it about the community saying, hang on a second, we can't just have male? I mean, we know crash test dummies are predominantly done on men as well. How do we move this forward?
That's right. I think it's conversations like this are a good start, and it's on, the onus is on first aid trainers and first aid organisations to try and have a, you know, a wide range of dummies to normalise performing CPR on breasts and on women and on anatomically different people, and so that if it can start in the training room, that's a good place to start.
Do we have enough of them around, whether it be sports clubs, shopping centres, workplaces? there's often campaigns that come in and out to get defibrillators in public places. Do we have enough?
Well, so South Australia is leading the kind of leading the world on this regard, and they've introduced some legislation that mandates exactly where AEDs must be installed in public locations, on buses, trains, train stations, and things like this. And we would love to see at the Heart Foundation that legislation replicated across the country. And we also want to see more of them registered with state ambulance services. So in Victoria there, the Victorian Ambulance runs an AED register that you can go on in advance and either find where your nearest one is or potentially register one that you know is at a business or a shop or even your own personal one that can guide responders to that in an emergency.
A couple of really great questions here for you, Simon. Simon Cowie, the sudden cardiac arrest lead at the Heart Foundation, is with you. We're talking about a campaign that's been started in Lismore at the Surf Life Saving Club called Don't Let Her Die of Embarrassment. So trying to get more of us as bystanders not be embarrassed to use defibrillators on women. So people are asking quite serious questions about bras and whether or not the underwire can cause any problems and whether or not the bra actually does need to be removed.
Yeah, the recommendation is to remove all clothing from the person's chest, be they male, female, you know, jackets, t-shirts, bras. In the majority of AEDs, there will be a pair of scissors in there. If for some reason you can't remove it, it is still fine to apply the AED pads and use it as instructed. And remember that the AED will give you prompts, will guide you on what to do. And also the 000 call taker will be on the phone with you and providing you that increased instructions and assurance on what you're doing. And we know that it doesn't matter what the reason is, that if someone is unconscious and not breathing, the response is always call, push, shock. So call 000, push hard and fast on the centre of the chest and shock with an AED.
This message has come through from Paula and it says, I attended CPR training just recently with the Community First Aid Responders Unit in Moorabbin. They have 4 female dummies. Isn't that great?
Wonderful to hear. Yes, yeah. Fantastic.
Go Moorabbin. Hey, stay with us, Simon. I want to speak to Vicky who's called through. Good morning, Vicky.
Good morning, Rochelle. Good afternoon, Rochelle.
It's like 7 minutes. It's still morning, Vicky.
Close enough.
What did you want to share? What's your story?
Okay, so back in 2018, I had a massive heart attack. I had a dissection of the aorta, top and bottom.
Wow.
And my life was saved by the beautiful doctors Vituka, Bendigo and the Alfred. And I just want to say, if you're mad because somebody touched your boobs, well, bad luck.
Yeah.
You're alive.
Yeah.
You're alive. And you should be grateful. I mean, what do you want them to let you go because you're on the street, you've had a heart attack?
Do you know what's interesting, Vicky, is that there's a text that's come in here from a man. I won't name them, but it says, men don't want to use it removing a woman's blouse or bra without her expressed or ongoing consent. It's not embarrassing. It's illegal, and goes on to say it's actually sexual assault. But that's not true,
that's
Simon,
not
is it?
Like.
No, that's untrue. And, I mean, I have a wife and a daughter, and I would be, wanting everyone to perform CPR on them regardless of what they're wearing or where in public
exactly.
they are.
Yeah. Vicky, how are you now?
I am hell of a lot better. I've got a perfectly good clear health record. I don't smoke anymore because of the heart attack. I'm doing well. I'm doing really well and I'm very grateful, as I said, to all the medical team.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for my granddaughter to take me to the hospital when I knew I was having thought I was having a heart attack. So, yeah, I've got to be grateful for everything. And like I said, whoever sees your boobs, you're not going to see them again. And they're probably married or they're probably men.
What? You probably got good boobs, Vicky, so who cares? Get them out,
say. Yeah, that's what my late husband say that.
Vicky, thank you, because it is really important. Simon, just while we have you, I want to have a chat to Cherie, who's called through. Good morning.
Good morning.
What would you like to share?
I'd just like to say, as a survivor of a heart attack, at an airport, very public place, I think the main situation is if you can just get people to turn away, instead of coming on like a car accident and everyone rubbernecking, and I think that would save a lot of embarrassment by a lot of females. But I'd also like to say I was defibrillated. My bra was still intact. I remember being on the table to have an angiogram done.
Wow.
And then cutting my brand new bra. I was more devastated about that.
Because they're expensive, aren't they?
I remember them cutting it off, like straight up the middle of it in the front.
But you're here to tell that story, Sheree, and I think that's the point as well. We're just hitting the news. Sheree, thank you for sharing that. I mean, she does raise a good point, just finally, Simon, in that, and a part of first aid training too, is to kind of clear, if you know what you're doing, if you're a first responder, if you're trained in first aid, is to kind of keep everybody calm and keep people back and to make sure that the space is safe. So, you know, if Sheree says, look, if a part of it is, like, we don't need an audience here unless you're going to help.
That's right. And if there are, you know, trained responders or if you're confident enough to ask people to do that, it is always great to try and protect someone's dignity in that instance. But what's really most important is that someone does the call, follows call, push, shock and really initiates that life-saving sequence as soon as possible.
Simon, would you hope for not just other surf life-saving clubs, but for businesses, workplaces to also get on board with a Don't Let Her Die of an Embarrassment campaign?
Absolutely, that would be fantastic. We'd love to see that right across the country. It's a great campaign by this surf club in Lismore, and it's a really good idea, and we'd love to see it replicated all over the country.
Simon, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Michelle.
Simon Cowie, sudden cardiac arrest lead at the Heart Foundation. And a huge thank you to all of you who have been donating to Our Village. That started really early this morning on our breakfast program. The most beautiful baby shower was held for Charnel. And the money raised for Our Village, which is a Melbourne charity providing all of those essentials that mums and parents and babies need, especially when they first come home. It's not too late. You can donate right through to the end of the day. You can go to abc.net.au/Melbourne if you would like to be able to donate to Our Village. And so huge, like close to $33,000 has been donated. So thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.